Well, good afternoon. If we could, if we could start up, let me introduce myself. My name is Michael Schiffer with the Stanley Foundation. You both, of course, know Michael Green and Bates Gill with CSIS. On behalf of the Stanley Foundation, and also on behalf of CSIS, let me welcome you here this afternoon. And I also want to extend my thanks, both personally and institutionally, to CSIS and to Mike and to Bates for their partnership on building an open and inclusive regional architecture in Asia, which has been a very interesting project and conversation that we've had the opportunity to engage in over the past several months. Let me just say before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. First, we had a slight logistical hitch, and so you've all gotten photocopies of the report. We do actually have final, nice, glossy, printed versions of the report that just didn't quite make it down here to be one to join us this afternoon. If you do want a final printed version, if you can make sure that they have your contact information when you leave, we'll be happy to put it in the post and get it to you within a couple of days. Secondly, before we start with the more substantive comments, I want to note, and this should go without saying, that the three of us speak only for ourselves and not for any of the other participants who took part in the conference that we held in St. Michael's this past November. The report represents our views, certainly not the views of the participants and not the views of CSIS or the Stanley Foundation. We do, however, have a couple of the participants who are at the St. Michael's Conference who have joined us this afternoon, and we may call on them if any of your questions are particularly tough and difficult for us to answer, but certainly invite them to join us in the discussion this afternoon. So with that, let me give you a 15 or 20-second introduction to the Stanley Foundation and then an introduction to the project, and then turn things over to Bates and Mike to talk a little bit more about the findings from our meeting and the recommendations in our report. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Stanley Foundation, we're a small operating foundation located in Iowa, which gives us the advantage, unlike our colleagues at CSIS, for being able to speak with moral authority for the United States. The foundation has a focus on international security issues and also advocates what we term principled multilateralism as a core value for the conduct of U.S. foreign policy. As such, one of the central goals of the foundation is to explore and examine what in practice multilateralism actually is, what principles animate it and perhaps impede or bound its implementation. What the different forms of multilateral arrangements, norms, and institutions critical for effective regional and global governance look like, and also to undertake in a very pragmatic way, or at least what we think is a very pragmatic way, an exploration of the myths and realities of multilateralism in different regional and security contexts. And that brings me to this project and this report. Asia, it's become something of a truism to say, is the most dynamic region in the world, encompassing rising powers, vibrant economic growth, traditional great power rivalries, and new transnational challenges. As perhaps is fitting for this dynamism, Asia is also a region that is awash in regional mechanisms, institutions, and arrangements, ranging from alliances to institutions such as ASEAN and APEC to ad hoc arrangements like the six-party talks. Yet, paradoxically, and also, I suppose, is an oft-repeated truism, Asia remains somewhat underdeveloped institutionally. Its architecture remains fluid, and the capabilities of the institutions that currently exist, or new ones that might be created, remain unclear. Why this is so and what to do about it is a source of rich and diverse debate. And it is in this context, this past November, that the Stanley Foundation and CSIS convened a meeting with some of the leading scholars, journalists, and government officials from the region, to engage in a dialogue about Asian regional architecture. We did so by placing on the table a number of straightforward but critical questions. Among them, how have views regarding regional multilateralism evolved? Will regional mechanisms become arenas for competition or for cooperation? What drives the debate about regionalism? What should be the role of ASEAN, APEC, the EAS, ARF, and other arrangements or forums? What challenges do the future regional institutional architecture have to take into account and address? What perspectives are there on the role of the United States in the region? In placing these questions on the table, we aim to create something of a conceptual matrix with national and regional perspectives on one axis and the functional challenges facing the region on the other. What we hope has emerged in this report is a capture of the dynamics shaping the emerging regional architecture, the challenges facing institution-building exercises in the region, and productive policy prescriptions for the United States and others as we strive to build a stable and prosperous Asia in the 21st century. With that, as perhaps something of an overlong introduction, let me now turn the floor over to Mike, who will summarize the discussions and findings of our November meeting.
Thank you. The way we've divided this up is that I will summarize for you some of the key findings that we took away from this meeting, and I'll reiterate what Michael Schiffer said, which is that the three of us put this conference report together, essentially stealing the intellectual capital of the very excellent participants who came to our conference from India, China, Singapore, Japan, and across the region. To put out what we think is happening with this debate in Asia about multilateral architecture, multilateral institution building. And so I'll try to capture briefly what's in the report in terms of our findings, and then Bates Gill will say a bit more about our preliminary recommendations. I should also say at the outset that we have commissioned from the participants' papers. We gave them a pretty specific template so that we could try to capture the debate within India or within Japan or within Korea about where Asia's future institutional arrangements and architecture should go, what the norms should be, what the relationship should be to the U.S. or Europe. And the papers are quite excellent, and we're going to work on putting them together into an edited volume. But the way things go, that will probably come out sometime in 2020. So we wanted to get the preliminary findings out because we thought it was quite interesting, and it is something of a moving target. We started with several hypotheses. We thought we saw in the institution building process in Asia evidence of what we called both the Kantian world and the Hobbesian world, which is to say we thought we saw evidence of increasing cooperation, integration, collective views of security and interdependence, and yet at the same time in Asia and even in this process of building institutions, we saw further evidence in that process of rivalry of the traditional Asian striving in a hierarchical situation for leadership, and all of the things that a realist would point to in the sort of Hobbesian world, and we thought we saw that. The conference over 3 days revealed that both are happening, basically, that you have in this process of institution building some important things happening. For example, in the academic literature, there's for years been discussion of bureaucracies for peace, that when you have these kind of multilateral efforts in institution building, bureaucracies within governments are empowered to start addressing common problems, and that tends to mitigate against nationalism and rivalry. And in virtually every country in the region, we think we see this happening, and certainly our authors and country reporters told us that was happening. You also see countries in the region, importantly China in particular, responsive to the norms that are being set in places like the ASEAN Regional Forum. Even though those are fairly low and fairly lowest common denominator, nevertheless, some basic rules about producing defense white papers or against the use of force. Some of these basic things are forcing governments to respond, and they pay something of a penalty if they don't at least appear to be adhering to those norms. So we see some evidence also of transnational cooperation on issues like HIV/AIDS or SARS or avian influenza. So that sort of reinforces the idea that in the beginning of this process, there is the Kantian element, the interdependence, cooperative, positive side of institution building. But we also heard very clearly in the debate among our Japanese, Korean, Chinese, and Indian colleagues evidence that there is a lot of competition in this process, a lot of competition, precisely because you don't have a common set of norms or values in the region, because there are unresolved historical and territorial issues, and because nationalism is quite pronounced across the region. So both realities are happening at the same time. That's where we came out overall. We saw four areas in particular where there are contested issues or contested views about what this process should do, what its aims are, what its participants should be, and so forth. The first of these contested issues is essentially the question of what norms this process would be advancing. I mean, in the EU process, it's very clearly the case that there is a Europe whole and free, and that there is a common normative base for integration, and advancing those common norms is part of what the EU is all about. In Asia, you have obviously very different value systems. And you see this being contested in debates about what kind of multilateralism. So our Japanese colleagues consistently employed the language of the Stanley Foundation, calling for principled multilateralism, arguing for narrowing the differences among nations, trying to establish higher levels of rule of law or governance, transparency, and so forth. And some echo of that from some of the other parties. The Chinese participants in particular emphasized that part of the purpose of institution building is to celebrate and protect the diversity of different systems within Asia, to make sure there isn't interference in internal affairs, which has some resonance, of course, in the history of ASEAN itself, one of the most important multinational organizations in Asia, which was founded on the principle of non-interference in internal affairs. So this normative debate, is this about building common values, raising the standards, pushing for better governance, rule of law, transparency, democracy, and political participation? Or is it about stabilizing the region, ensuring peace by using multilateral forums to ensure non-interference in each other's affairs and try to prevent that from causing more rivalry? Unresolved and still debated today in the region, but you could hear it quite clearly in the conference. The second was the question of who is in Asia. And again, here you had very different discussion points. The Chinese view tended to be that Asia is basically the 10 ASEAN countries, Japan, Korea, and China. Everyone else, thank you for your interest in Asia. We'll let you know how it goes. The Australian view obviously is more open, inclusive of a trans-Pacific connection and even a European connection. Japan often in this process expressing that view. So who is in, whether India is in or not? Not surprisingly, the Indian view was that India is in, consistent with the look east policy of New Delhi. But within the region, particularly in Beijing, some question about whether New Delhi really belongs in this process. The U.S., you know, even within governments and even within the debate of academic communities within countries, there's debate about how much the U.S. should be involved. This also, I think, is unresolved even within countries like Japan, how much the U.S. is in this. The East Asia Summit, the U.S. is not a member of, but it has been designed in a way that the U.S. theoretically could join if we signed the Treaty of Amity and Commerce and were willing to send and cooperation and were willing to send the president out for two visits a year and so forth. So there's some ambiguity in this. And one thing I think we took away was, and this was a point brought home to us by our colleague Greg Sheridan from Australia, that probably most of the region likes it that way, likes to have a fluidity and a variety of multilateral institutions, because there are many dimensions to Japan's foreign policy personality. There are many dimensions to Australia's. And there is some advantage in having a fluid series of different institutions being formed, so you can use the ones that work for you best, and you don't foreclose any options, but you're hedging because you're not certain in the long run where China or the U.S. or the big powers are going. So our sense was this debate also will not be resolved easily. You'll have a multiplicity of institutions. Third contested issue is about the nature of the economic integration process. And here you also have a question of who's in and debates about whether the liberalization process should be ASEAN plus 3, Japan, Korea, and China, ASEAN plus 6, which is those plus Australia, India, New Zealand. Don't need to tell you who favors that one. or a Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement or agenda based on APEC or on President Bush's recent proposal for a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. And you have different views of that. You also have different questions about what kind of trade liberalization. We had a lot of discussion about whether there is a spaghetti bowl effect, whether these various free trade agreements or sub-regional agreements distort trade in ways that hurt U.S. business. I don't think we came to a clear conclusion about that one. But in general, many of these free trade agreements in the region, I am not including U.S.-Australia or the current U.S.-Korea negotiation, but many of the free trade agreements, for example, China's discussions with ASEAN, have so many exemptions that the danger of a spaghetti bowl effect of trade distortion or of disadvantageous positions for outsiders may be exaggerated. But then that raises another problem, which is the danger of lowering the standards of trade liberalization and distracting energy away from the WTO and global process, which for the U.S. is a real concern. Finally, considerable debate about who provides public goods in the region. The U.S. approach was articulated. Our principal paper writer was Ralph Kossa, who spends a lot of time on these things. And the U.S. approach generally is to be functional, to get things done, to be results-oriented. In many ways, the Tsunami Relief Core Group formed with the U.S., Japan, India, and Australia is an example of that very functional approach to multilateralism. But from members of ASEAN, we heard an interest in trying to find ways for ASEAN or the ASEAN plus three to provide public goods, especially with regard to transnational security threats. A number of the participants said, made the point that in a real crisis in Asia, nobody gets on the phone and says, my God, we've got to call the ASEAN Regional Forum. Or somebody get the Shanghai Cooperation Organization on the phone, we've got a crisis in Asia. That just doesn't happen. They call Washington. And most people agree that that's going to be the reality for some time to come. So the question is, how do you get these institutions to do more to provide public goods to help share the burden in effect? And Michael Hanlon did a really excellent paper thinking through what the requirements would be for humanitarian relief and these kind of operations in the future and how you could structure institutions to maybe share some of that burden. So those are the four contested areas. We did, as I said, find that there are real areas of cooperation. They are most substantive in areas that do not involve traditional state-to-state security. So that would be transnational threats like piracy, disease, counterterrorism, where there is some real cooperation going within ASEAN, within the ASEAN plus three, and within APEC. And that certainly is worth nurturing. I will stop there and let Bates describe how we fixed all this.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Let me, first of all, extend my personal and our institutional appreciation to Michael Schieffer and the Stanley Foundation for reaching out, working with us, being so generous both intellectually and financially and allowing us to move ahead with this project. We had an excellent set of discussions in St. Michael's in November, and we were very, very pleased with the entire cooperative venture, looking forward very much to more. Thanks as well to our many participants. Have a look at the list of folks there in the latter pages of our report. You'll see we were able to attract some really stellar talent from all over the region, and we're fortunate, as Mike and Michael both mentioned today, to have three of those participants with us, and we're looking forward to hearing some comments from them later this afternoon. The recommendations, as they appear in this report, are predominantly focused on the U.S. policy audience. Mike Green and I felt that, you know, sitting in Washington, being in a sense most attuned to these debates as they're unfolding in the policy community, we thought we could make the best contribution by trying to focus our thoughts there. I think it can be summarized, really, the recommendations that we're putting forward can really be readily summarized in the very title of this report, with the emphasis on the words open and inclusive. And with that, all that said, we can go through some of these somewhat quickly. I don't want to go through all 10 or 11 specific recommendations. But number one, obviously, is the need even as we undertake some deeper and more flexible consideration of Asian multilateral security organizations, the United States absolutely must continue to invest in strengthening its network of alliance relationships with Japan, Korea, and Australia in particular, and to continue to explore and expand where possible new partnerships in the region, such as those that has been established with India. These don't have to be formalized or institutionalized necessarily, as are the alliance relationships, and we would support the notion that we need to think more creatively and innovatively to build what we might call ad hoc multilateral arrangements similar, for example, to the partnership which emerged in the wake of the 2004 tsunami, bringing together the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India in an effective response. That example was often brought up in a positive light during the course of the conference as an example, both from sort of the American side of the positive contribution that this style of multilateralism can bring, but I think also from the Asian community as well as a much appreciated effort on the part of the United States, many have said, to help rebuild, in fact, the American image in the region. At the end of the day, then, we do not see alliances and other forms of multilateralism and cooperation in the region as being mutually exclusive, but rather, if anything, here in Washington, we need to push ahead on the notion that they can indeed be symbiotic and mutually reinforcing. And so, as part of that, then, a second major recommendation is here in Washington, we need to be even more encouraging and willing to accept activities and leadership by our friends and partners in the region as they pursue forms of Asian multilateralism, even if it might mean from time to time that the United States is not included. It's in many ways more important, we argue, that if an American idea or American values and approaches and interests can be achieved through a process which is 95% Asian, quote-unquote, that's almost surely going to be better than trying to force down the throats of the region an idea which would be labeled 95% American, the notion being that we can find ways of common interests, common values, shared approaches with our friends and allies in the region, and we should encourage them then to put those ideas forward in multilateral ways, even if it might mean that we're not directly involved. We took on board and continue to take very seriously, third, the message that we heard loud and clear from our Asian friends in St. Michael's, and that is, rightly or wrongly, the perception is, we think mostly wrongly, but nevertheless it's there, the perception that somehow or another America is not engaged in the Asia-Pacific, that we have somehow abandoned our commitments to multilateralism there, or that worse, we've maintained a kind of dismissiveness about these activities. We would argue, and we do in the report, quite to the contrary, but we recognize that the perception is there, and that we need to do a better job here in the United States of making sure that that perception continues to be dispelled. A part of that is going to have to be, and one of our recommendations is to ensure that the U.S. Secretary of State continues to be fully engaged and participating in important activities of Asian regionalism, primarily, of course, the ASEAN Regional Forum, and also to maintain the commitment of our president to be attending and fully participating and leading at the forum of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. We also recommend that we in the United States should continue to take a serious look at the possibilities of becoming a member of the East Asia Summit, the EAS, that we should see this as an opportunity for us to strengthen our linkages in the region, and this is a way of reaffirming our commitments to regional norms and aims. Hopefully, in a very pragmatic way, Such participation in the EAS, if it were to come by the United States, could be worked out through its scheduling process so that the president could perhaps participate both in APEC at one point and then back-to-back be participating in the EAS as well. I mean, like it or not, one of the big logistical hurdles to the whole notion of participating in the EAS is simply trying to get the U.S. president out to this part of the world twice in a year. These are some of the broader thoughts about American participation and our approach to these issues. We also recommend that we need to work more carefully and closely with China to assure that China is fully embedded and fully committed to the regional norms that are emerging, that China does take on all the more commitments towards such issues as confidence-building measures, establishing new forms of cooperation in the region to deal with regional challenges, and importantly, internalizing over time, we hope, the common norms and goals which we can identify both the United States and our friends and allies in the region. This is obviously would be done primarily through the multilateral channels, where China is going to likely be most comfortable. But at the same time, this is a set of issues that we can continue to hammer away at in our bilateral relationship with China as well. On the economic front, we have a number of recommendations, including the necessity to complete the U.S. Republic of Korea Free Trade Agreement and to push for a simultaneous discussion on free trade developments such as the Trans-Pacific free trade arrangement that is favored by the United States, that has a trans-Pacific nature to it, which would go forward in parallel with the development of free trade arrangements that have a more of a narrow Asia focus, such as the ASEAN plus three free trade area. In other words, we're arguing here that these two forms of free trade arrangements need not be mutually exclusive or competitive with one another. And we recognize that the United States has to do much to try and reinvigorate the APEC agenda and also to reinvigorate the new ASEAN-U.S. enhanced partnership, again, as a means to more strongly demonstrate our commitment to Asian multilateralism. Again, not unlike the overall perception of American disengagement, if you will, from the region, we heard very loudly and clearly that the perception of the American response to the 1997 financial crisis in Asia is one that's left a very sour taste in the mouths of many, particularly in Southeast Asia. China has taken full advantage of that perception in presenting itself as a more reliable economic partner. We need to do some rebuilding of those sorts of bridges and offer, as appropriate, judicious and useful financial support and advice across Asia, including working with organizations such as the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank in order to rebuild America's role as a leader in terms of investment, free trade, and economic development in the region. And then in conclusion, and I think we were able to put this out at least initially prior to the recent successes of of Chris Hill and company in the six-party talks, but we also recommend here that it is important to look at the six-party talks process and think through how it can be institutionalized going forward into a multilateral, a formal multilateral, longer-term security mechanism that can help address the issues well beyond the nuclear questions we have about North Korea and begin addressing the broader security challenges that that part of the world faces. So those are, in a nutshell, our recommendations. We definitely look forward to your comments, and I hope, too, we'll have a chance to hear from some of the other participants in our at our conference, which include Ellen Frost, who is with the National Defense University, as well as the Peterson Institute of International Economics. I think she's here, and Mike O'Hanlon was joined with us in St. Michael's from the Brookings Institution, and Evan Medeiros is also with us here today, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. So please, we very much look forward to your comments, questions, criticisms. Thank you.
Anytime. Yes.
We had a number of views on that in the conference. I think I don't want to suggest this is the authoritative view from Seoul necessarily, but I think our author from the ROK described how in many ways multilateral institution building for Seoul is a way to start getting a handle on the North Korea problem. But nobody in this discussion, and this is just one discussion, although I think one that includes people who are, actively in this debate in their home countries, nobody suggested, for example, that North Korea should join APEC. North Korea is already in the ASEAN Regional Forum, and then they're in the six-party talks, and those are the two arena where they could play more of a role if they step up and do what's expected of them on the nuclear front and some of these other areas. With respect to China, I agree with you. I think we all felt that China's participation in APEC and in multilateral institutions is a generally positive thing. There was concern from a number of the participants about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, about whether or not whether or not China really had an interest in an open, inclusive architecture. I think the answer is probably yes, but there was a little bit of ambiguity to it. And one of the things we felt strongly is that we need to find ways for the U.S. and China to demonstrate that in this institution-building process, even though you have these contested issues about the norms and who's in or who's out, that the U.S. and China can have projects, significant initiatives, that we work together and we expand our cooperation to demonstrate, that the two large powers are viewing this institution process as win-win, to try to move it away from the competitive aspect that we saw clearly there.
Yes, I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council and the Malaysia America Society. Bates, you mentioned the importance of completing the FTA with South Korea and with ASEAN. What about completing the FTA with Malaysia?
Why are you asking that, Tom?
I have no idea.
I might let Mike Green offer up a couple more comments related to the US-ROK. Free trade agreement, because he's been working that issue a little bit. But I can say, just in very brief, that that particular issue did not arise. So that may be a bad reflection on our part, although I would think that as a general principle, as part of our overall approach to these issues, I that doesn't mean that we don't favor it. It's just that it didn't arise in our conversations.
And I mean, if I can just make one sort of quick comment on that, I don't think in the context of our conversations or discussions, there's certainly any opposition or any question about engaging with Malaysia. But I think, as a practical matter, in terms of U.S. politics, the South Korea Accord has become a matter of theological dispute. And if we can get past South Korea, then all other things are possible. And if we can't, then it's largely irrelevant what the merits are for any other particular case or country.
Mi-Young-Yun of Woodrow Wilson Center. Thank you for your presentation. Considering the enormity of the task and problems within the region, your presentation and recommendation sounds very tangible and practical, but still, I have some question about the principled multilateralism. What is that disciplined or principled multilateralism? You said it's about democracy and the rule by law, but still, that kind of principle or democracy could be used as a pretext for exclusion, and it could be easily used as a sort of interventionism to address domestic politics. What could you, in that case, there could be the cause of regional rather conflict or dispute. What could you a little bit more articulate about that disciplined or principled multilateralism?
I can certainly try to answer it to some degree from the perspective of the Stanley Foundation. Others may have other views, and I guess this is perhaps the both the beginning and the ending of my comments. It is a concept that is very much malleable and still under discussion. I would say, there is a long and ongoing debate as to exactly what principles you include in and what salience they should have in guiding the concept. Certainly from the Foundation's perspective, when we approach the concept of principled multilateralism, we start with inclusivity as one of our core principles, and that one of the guideposts ought to be trying to understand the perspectives of the other players in the game so that you can seek to forge effective and durable solutions. So I think from the Foundation's perspective, when we discuss principled multilateralism, it's not at all meant to suggest any sort of exclusivity. Having said that, I mean, there is obviously also a certain amount of normative content, and one does not, even for a foundation that is very supportive of the concept of principled multilateralism, one does not pursue multilateralism at all at any costs. For different people, different countries, different institutions at different points in time, there may be lines that are drawn depending upon what one's principles may happen to be.
This is also a term the Japanese government has started using, and some others in the region. And it, like all terms in international relations, can mean a little bit different thing to different people. But I think the fundamental question is whether stability, whether these institutions and the multilateral architecture enhances stability in Asia because it allows countries to arbitrate differences by not interfering in each other's internal affairs, that basically it solidifies or protects diversity and therefore builds confidence, which is the view in Beijing and some other areas. Or does this multilateral institution building enhance stability because it also starts creating some common rules of behavior, some common norms, which is certainly the lesson from integration in Europe in the 21st century, in the 20th and 21st centuries. In some ways, there is a lot of gray area in between. It's not necessarily black or white. And you'll notice that we did not, for example, call for an Asia-Pacific democracy coalition or a grouping that would be exclusive based on norms that we share with countries like Japan or India. There are some people who call for that. We thought it would be more harmful than good. We did recommend that the U.S. and like-minded countries that have an interest in raising the standard across the region in terms of economic questions of intellectual property rights or transparency or governance or rule of law or political liberalism or women's empowerment, the countries that share those views ought to quietly, in a way that isn't exclusive, quietly find ways to coordinate and share views on how we can encourage more participation across the region and in these institutions in strengthening these norms. One of the things we did find, I think, is that even though you have something of a debate about multilateralism to protect diversity versus multilateralism to build more common values, even though you had that debate, Chinese friends said, look, you know, in the ASEAN Plus 3 and in the Chiang Mai Initiative, China is playing a role to help raise standards within Southeast parts of Southeast Asia in terms of economic transparency and accountability. So I think the challenge is to find ways to recognize that there's diversity within Asia and there are different paths to political liberalization, to economic opening. But there are some common denominators, and we need to try to reinforce those. I think that's, if I can speak for my colleagues, that's basically where we came out, that to ignore the importance of raising the standards and the norms in the region would be a mistake and would be a misuse of these institutions that are building.
Zhong Jianden from National Change University, Taiwan. I'm just wondering, first, I thank you for your presentation and bringing us together to discuss this very interesting subject. My question is that why we have bothering to have such a new structure? We already have APEC. We still remember APEC based upon open regionalism. It is just like an inclusive open structure there. And the initiator, or we can say it's a cooperation between Japan and Australia. And in 1993, by the initiative of President Clinton, its further development is that we have a summit there. In the past almost two decades, we have thousands of working groups, meetings, committee meetings, lots of this kind of meetings there, and other standards, norms there. Why bothering have this kind of new structure? If APEC doesn't work, then why do you think that this new structure will work well? And also, if you think this structure is good, maybe I think that it has something to do with this new structure might be dominant by the United States. I mean, with regard to APEC, there's no dominant force so much evident there. Of course, the cooperation between Japan, Australia, and to a lesser degree, South Korea, that's there. So that's my question. Thank you very much.
That's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up because apparently we may have been misinterpreted in the way we presented our findings and recommendations, because I think I can speak for everyone up here and for most of our participants, we would be very much in agreement with you, in fact, on a lot of the points you raised. You said something that we are suggesting some kind of new architecture. That's not the case at all. If you look carefully at the report and at the recommendations as we put them out, in fact, we're suggesting that we not build something new or different, but in fact we figure out ways to make what is there work better. And that would obviously include APEC, and there are recommendations in here related to that. So I think I'm glad you raised it because we need to clarify that. We're not talking about some sort of yet another new overarching alphabet soup collection of organizations. Quite the contrary, in fact. We're asking the question, we got a lot of things there now. What's working? What's not? What can be reinforced? What can be made better? Is there anyone else want to add to that? Or?
Just to say that one of the consistent themes, and I think this was something pretty much everyone agreed on, is we're not going to make this tidy. We're not going to be able to sort of clean this up and get rid of the ones that don't work and sort of create one nice mechanism. There are a lot of bureaucratic and ideational and cultural and strategic reasons why there will be a lot of these different things out there. And the key is to make sure that even though we can't necessarily rationalize the institutions, we ought to have some intelligent design about the agenda and what we can achieve and how we and use it to strengthen stability and improve the normative standards in the region.
I'm sorry. One of the longer-term hopes that we would like to see achieved from this project as we move from this conference and into the book project and other related activities is to answer the question, given the challenges that we can identify before us over the next 10, 15, 20 years in the region, which institutions and mechanisms are going to be best suited to address A, B, and C? Which are going to be best suited to address D, E, and F? And what do we now need to do to strengthen those institutions so that they can be more effective in addressing those multiplicity of challenges? So that surely does not exclude. In fact, I think it leaves the door very much open for an organization like APEC to step up and be a more effective group.
Thank you, Paul Chamberlain. I tend to pay closer attention to Northeast Asia topics than from Tashkent to Tasmania. But I want to compliment you for beginning, at least in my mind, a discussion about a truly fascinating subject. And then as an old soldier, I start thinking, what are the objectives that we're trying to achieve? Now, and I've not really been able to read the report. I look forward to it. You know, wanting to build a better system, build a better watch, you know, has a lot of merit to it. But as I think about modernization and globalization and the inevitable transformation of societies to as they become modern systems, I find myself wondering how this applies. And is there a problem with U.S. objectives, or was that even a factor in the consideration of this report? Policy recommendations imply there's certain objectives to be addressed, and I skimmed this. I didn't see what those objectives were or interests are. I mean, I have some imagination, but to make sure everybody's on the same sheet of music, is that clarified in the report? And how should we think about this in terms of advancing an American agenda is not the right word, but to advance America's presence in the region? And I guess the last question I have is, would it be feasible or legal to put the papers from the St. Mary's Conference on the CSIS website if they're not there already, so we can share your enthusiasm for that work? Thank you very much.
Well, the we did not approach the conference as a we didn't do the Army METI. You know, we didn't approach this as a strategic operation planning exercise where we had our objectives and our. We were doing this as a social science experiment in a way. We wanted to see when we took this sort of cross-cutting set of functional challenges and then how each country and the region tends to look at multilateralism and see if the national views or the national debate about what kind of institutions are appropriate meshes with the challenges we face in the region so we could think about how to, as Bates said, use what we have more effectively rather than try to, you know, recommend some grand new machine or design. So from that perspective, we wanted to see those trends, and from that we drew some implications for the U.S. I think you'll see within the recommendations pretty clearly what we all think U.S. objectives are, which obviously are, I think, bipartisan, if broad, and that is we want peace and stability. We want we want open and inclusive economic opportunities. We want our values to be advanced because that's in the interest of stability. And that's sort of a perennial, and that's what you see behind this particular report for U.S. audiences. In terms of the working papers, we have the authors. We're being very harsh to our authors, and we've sent back comments, and we're still in the process of rewriting and trying to get a set of papers that has the same template and tries to answer the same questions. So we're not quite there yet. They'd probably be very happy to just be done with it and put it on the website, but we're harder taskmasters than that.
I just wanted to add on to what Mike said. I mean, I think we very much approach the discussions less as a question of what U.S. Objectives were, and more, what are the functional challenges? I think, as Bates said before, that the region faces, whether they're new trade patterns, whether they're new transnational threats like avian flu and influenza, and then how do we go about addressing those functional challenges? And there's an inbuilt assumption in that, although it's an assumption that I think has some merit, that American interests are well served by being able to promote greater stability in the region, by being able to promote greater integration in the region, by assuring economic growth and dynamism continues, and so forth.
Just one final coda. I mean, I think we came out of – there's a lot of hyperventilation about this issue in Washington and to some extent in the region, especially from our friends in Singapore. And you get this image of the U.S. being pushed out by this new architecture that's being formed. And we, I think, collectively thought it's much more fluid and complicated and multidimensional than that. And instead of hyperventilating about whether the U.S. is in or out, we need to try to shift the debate towards how we're smarter about getting what we want to have in the region. And that includes, as Bates said, not necessarily having the U.S. out in front of every issue and recognizing that there are others in the region who are pulling their oars in the same direction. We need to be smarter about how we partner with countries. But at the same time, we do need to show our interest. It is important that our Secretary of State goes to the ARF every year, that we don't appear to be disinterested.
As we think about Asian integration, or at least as I do, I think about European integration. And from an economic standpoint, I think that the United States has been something of a loser with economic, with European integration. I mean, our trade with the European Union, I think, is quite different, quite less than that with other major regions. So do you have an image of Asia integrating a la Europe or something else, or are we not really quite at that point of even establishing a vision?
Good question, Paul. Thank you. And I think, maybe we should ask Ellen Frost to respond to this, but my quick point would be this. From our side of the table, if you will, or from our corner of the table where some of the U.S. folks sat, clearly our message was Trans-Pacific economic integration and lots of flags being raised here and there about an exclusive Pan-Asia economic integration. That doesn't mean that we intend to stop it or that we should try or that we ought to disrupt it, but rather to reinforce the notion that, you know, our interests do lie in integrative processes in the Trans-Pacific region, and we need to be more active in doing it. Why don't you chime in here, Ellen? Ellen Frost from the Peterson Institute of International Economics and the National Defense University.
Well, I would have to take issue with the comment about Europe, and that's because you're leaving out the investment dimension. The U.S.-Europe relationship is the biggest single combined trade and investment relationship in the world, and that's where American companies in this globalized age invest and trade with their own subsidiaries across the Pacific or within Europe. While I have the floor, let me just make one quick comment that picks up on several things mentioned here. How do we promote U.S. objectives? Why do we need architecture and more architecture? Why do Asians want more architecture? And that's what I want to say briefly. Americans tend to look at these organizations and say, well, what are the results? It's just a talk shop. You know, what are the results? What do they actually do? There's a kind of hidden agenda here. Which is that this new architecture, and in particular the proliferation of all these so-called free trade agreements, actually are mechanisms for a number of Asian goals. One is engaging a rising China in a web of agreements. Another one is mitigating Sino-Japanese tensions, or at least keeping them under a roof where others can help to mitigate them. A third one is getting the attention of the United States. There's really a lot going on behind the scenes, and that's why, as Bates and Mike said so skillfully, it's important for us to be very subtly in that game, not to start the process by sailing over there and saying, well, here are our objectives. You're either for us or against us. That's not at all what the report says. It says, first, let's understand what the motives are and then see how we can accommodate.
You Goodman with Stonebridge International. I also wanted to ask about Europe, but at a more fundamental level, what lessons learned you drew from European integration? And there, I'm not an expert on Europe, but my understanding is that European integration was primarily driven by the experience of long warfare between the states, and particularly in between France and Germany, and a desire to sort of have a pattern of relationships that would sort of prevent that kind of eventuality in the future. And the question, so there's a sort of clear organizing principle, and maybe the Cold War was another rationale, but again, a clear organizing principle. In the case of Asia, there's, as Ellen's just mentioned, there are at least three or four different things that I can think of off the top of my head that might be the the organizing principles behind this, but does it make it more, I mean, just what is the relevance of Europe, and does the fact that there isn't a clear organizing principle for multilateralism in Asia make it more difficult to achieve whatever the objectives are?
I'll just make a very brief opening comment on that. First to say that what we're probably witnessing at this point here in 2007 appears to be the second big wave of academic and policy interest on the question of East Asian multilateralism and integration. The first big wave was in the early 1990s, shortly after the end of the Cold War. So it was a bit of deja vu to a lot of this, although much has changed since then. And at that time, and if one goes back, and maybe we need to do a better job of going back and speaking to this, reams of literature were generated which asked this exact question and took it back and forth and lots of great debate. My takeaway from all of that activity, and I believe it even today, is that Europe generally, so it would be in agreement with you, as a sort of general framework or model, it's probably not a smart idea to try to just pick up that template and stick it in Asia for the very reasons you say, because there lacks that same motivating force, all-powerful motivating force around which everybody can kind of agree, which helped drive European integration, and, of course, all the other issues of history, culture, religion, language, which offered a similar sort of ballast of commonality which the Europeans could turn to. Indeed, the very debate about Turkey integration into Europe raises all those questions once again. So that's one big general point that I think is important. However, there are aspects of European integration that I think are useful to look to, and actually have been in the real world beyond the beyond the conference halls of St. Michael's. For example, I would point to the success of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in demarcating and demilitarizing borders between China and its Central Asian neighbors. They pulled right out of the OSCE playbook, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I mean, almost to the exact language, to try and implement then agreements and understandings about how they were going to achieve confidence-building measures across those disputed borders. So there are lessons, but your point is exactly right. We're going to be disappointed if we try to just transplant it whole hog. It's just not going to work.
Although, if I can just point to one other area where I think there are some lessons learned that also do show through in this report. We tend to look back now at the growth of the European Union and sort of assume that there was the one big idea all the time that motivated and drove the process. If you go back, my own knowledge of this is about that thin, so I hope that there aren't going to be any probing follow-up questions, but if you go back to the early history, recall that the experimentation with European integration was driven by very, very narrow, almost technical problem-solving organizations like the European Coal and Steel Community. And it was only after several decades of iterative game playing that built confidence and built shared values that the European Union, as we know it today, was able to come into existence. And so when we look at Asia today as this messy, sort of fluid, spaghetti bowl of architectural institutions, which is a horrible metaphor, and I apologize for that. There is something in the history of how European integration grew and developed, starting with these very pragmatic problem-solving institutions that I think we can look at and that may suggest something for how we can go about effectively building institutions in the Asia-Pacific community as well.
Thank you. This is a fascinating topic. Just briefly to supplement what was said, you do hear, as you know, Matthew, from working on this, you do hear in the context of the Chiang Mai Initiative specific reference to the Coal and Steel Union and things like that and these early technical discussions, and it's really happening in the Chiang Mai Initiative. And I would argue it's in U.S. interests, and I think we all came out there, that this kind of cooperation is happening as long as it's transparent to us, consistent with the IMF, WTO and other global rules, it generally is positive. One of the debates in St. Michael's, and I think the debates that will continue about this for some time is whether that in and of itself is enough or whether you really need to deal with some of the very different political systems you have in Asia, how far that technical cooperation will get you until you run into the problem that you have these different political systems and these unresolved historical issues, which are, of course, much more difficult to resolve because you have different political systems. So that's a debate for the ages, perhaps. May not happen as quickly enough for us to answer here.
Ron Huskin, Australian National University. I flew a long way to ask this question. I think this question has been inspired by the previous two, I think. One of the conspicuous features of Asian multilateralism, if you like, is that it's driven by the little guys in the region thus far. The flip side of which, I think, is that there's been a disinclination on the part of the big guys, the heavyweights, to set up a process between themselves which they stamp with their authority and in which they take responsibility to address the issues in which they are the primes, if you like. And it seems to me that has been and will remain a sort of fundamental retardant, if you like, to the development of regionalism in East Asia. And the contrast with Europe is marked, where the process has been extraordinarily successful. It remains the benchmark of multilateralism anywhere. And a process that was very much driven by the two heavyweights, France and Germany in that case. I just wondered if that came up at all in the discussions last November. Thank you.
It's a good point, and I think it did come up and comes up, you know, in this discussion of this topic from time to time. The big guys have initiated multilateral forums and institutions, of course. The six-party talks, which is a substantive and I think now enduring feature of this architecture, was an American idea endorsed by Japan and finally bought into by China. And, of course, the ROK was at the center of it. And this was all the big guys. It's addressing, and we pay some attention to it, it's addressing the nuclear issue, but it is designed to lead eventually, and I think all the participants in the process, all six parties now agreed with this, it's designed to eventually form a more lasting institution and with some self-conscious design, some glance at the OSCE process as well, so that the basket of issues now being addressed in the six-party process, there are five working groups. One of them is on establishing economic cooperation. One of them is on an armistice replacement, a permanent peace mechanism, which opens up all sorts of security issues, not necessarily Taiwan or the Northern Territories, but certainly around the Korean Peninsula. So you do have the big guys doing this. And APEC, of course, was an Australian-Japanese invention. So it's a mix. But I think the ones people talk about a lot today, the EAS, the ASEAN Plus 3, those are ASEAN. It's the little guys very skillfully controlling the big guys and keeping control of the process. That brings some advantage because it tends to mitigate against the rivalry among the big players. You'll recall when in 2004 and early 2005, when it wasn't clear whether the East Asia Summit process would be owned by ASEAN or owned by the host, with Beijing set to host at some future date, that was a crisis moment for ASEAN. They regained control. And I think that ultimately suited the interests of the big powers, too. So it's a mix. But I think you're right that the region-wide forums are generally ASEAN-centered with respect to security, like the ARF. And that's going to be both an advantage but also a limitation, I think.
Let me make one quick comment, then. Just picking up where Mike was going, I really appreciate the comment, Ron, because it does drive us to think even more deeply and innovatively on some of these issues. It strikes me that, as Mike says, region-wide, you know, these seem to be mechanisms which are driven by the little guys, and there are good reasons for that. But in instances where serious strategic challenges can be readily identified as common, and most deeply affecting the major players, I think we may well see a greater and greater willingness for this ad hoc multilateralism to come to the fore. I mean, the six-party talks is a form of ad hoc multilateralism, just as the four-party talks were before that. Similarly, we point a lot in the report to the gathering of the United States and India and Australia and Japan to focus on the tsunami relief question. There's the other good example, more recent example, of the gathering of the United States, China, Korea, Japan, and some others. I can't remember energy. on the energy issue, energy and clean and global climate change initiative. So maybe what we're really seeing here is, you know, when there is a readily identifiable strategic challenge around which the big guys can circle, we might be hopeful that it can happen more often. But if it's simply a more consensus-building, lowest common denominator, comfort level approach that's needed, then everybody can gather around, and it's okay for the smaller guys to push that forward.
Evan?
Thanks. I'm Evan Medeiros from the RAND Corporation. I have two questions about the recommendations. Firstly, when you talk about building on or enhancing the alliances, it's always talked about in the context of Japan, Korea, and Australia. And so I would invite you guys to talk a little bit about our other allies in the region, because they're not mentioned here at all, and I think there was some interesting discussion at the conference about that. My second question was about the language about examining modalities for signing the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation. Specifically, what do you mean by examining modalities? I mean, presumably we've examined them already, and that's why the U.S. rejected it. So our friends in Australia have figured out sufficient legal gymnastics to sign on to it without undermining their security commitments. So I was wondering if you guys were trying to be kind of cagey, or could you be more forward-leaning than examining modalities? I mean, is this essentially, are you suggesting that the U.S. sign the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, or that the United States, it looks very likely that we could do that. So I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that. And just lastly, regarding this recommendation about simultaneous sessions of the East Asia Summit and APEC, given the fact that the EAS in past years has also occurred, I believe, at the same time as ASEAN Plus 3, are you really proposing a kind of two-week-long Asia stock of multilateral forums in Asia where we could just go over there and spend 2 weeks talking our heads off?
Like Woodstock or
Bali stock.
Basically, yes. That you know, you pick and choose, but you know, remember, I mean, I've been at these summits. Matthew Goodman has, some others here have, with their governments. You know, the joint declarations, the initiatives are kind of important, but the really important thing is when John Howard and Koizumi talk, or when Hu Jintao and Abe talk, or, you know, the really important thing, sort of like a conference, say, it, for example, at St. Michael's, the really important thing is the conversations you have in the hallway, the bilats, and it's the convening aspect of it that's really important as well. So, you know, if you had a sort of mix of these things and leaders could pick and choose, but use that to get other things done and to develop a broad agenda for the region, it's useful. Part of the danger of having, these things over two or three different months is that depending on who's there, you can water down agreements. For example, if APEC reaches a certain agreement on certain things, there's a danger it gets watered down in ASEAN Plus 3 and so forth. So there's some utility in having collective discussion. TAC and modalities. I mean, the Japanese and Australian government's modality for signing the TAC was to sign the TAC and then take these fingers and cross them and put them behind their back and basically put out a side letter. And we, in discussing this, and when I left the government a year ago, but, you know, there was a lot of discussion about how you would do this. In our system, the Senate ratifies treaties. And so the Senate would have an opportunity in a treaty that included Burma, for example, to do an awful lot of mischief or put an awful lot of writers or and Michael Schiffer knows this better than I do. So the question was, is there a way you can do this to declare an intention to sign. Could you sign but not submit it for ratification? Are there ways to do this? But we ought to be exploring it. I've just anecdotally found, to my surprise, I did a briefing on this issue on the Hill, and I was surprised how many staffers were aware of this issue, knew about the EAS, knew about the TAC, had been thinking about it. And I was also surprised how much willingness there was among some of the important operational committees to explore ways to do this, maybe just pass it and ratify it. I think if it's important enough to the president of the U.S., we'd do it. My guess is it won't happen in this administration because we don't know yet quite how – well, the administration isn't quite sure yet how serious the EAS is going to be. But I think this will be high on the agenda for the next administration. Do you want to do any alliances or the other?
We probably should be asking you, given all the work you've been doing. That's why we invited you to St. Michael's to make some comments on the other alliances that we were not able to tackle. I mean, obviously, you know, the best excuse I can probably offer at this stage is that we were limited in the amount of persons and issue areas that we could cover. But clearly, what we're saying about the need to strengthen and reinvigorate and improve alliance relationships with regard to Korea, Australia, and Japan would surely apply to the cases of the Philippines and Thailand and other important relationships, as with Singapore. But seriously, I would be keen, if you wouldn't mind giving your 2 minutes' worth take based upon your work about how we would approach these other alliance relationships.
Do you want to weigh in on alliances, Evan, or?
I mean, Bates, I think the important point is just to for people interested in our exercise here to understand that your emphasis or our collective emphasis on the importance of the alliance as essentially the centerpiece of a regional security architecture is not exclusive of our other allies. I mean, simply because Thailand and the Philippines weren't mentioned in this, and I think that the fact that the United States has designated both countries as non-NATO allies and has been pretty active in expanding the scope of regional security cooperation from them is an indication that those alliances continue to play an important role. Obviously, those two particular countries, because of the, let's say, the political challenges they face and some of the economic challenges they face, specifically the Philippines in particular, that limits their ability to be robust alliance partners, certainly on the scale of Japan, Korea, or Australia. But again, I think the important point is that when we talk about allies, not to suggest that there's any kind of tiering of the allies per se, but just understanding the scope of cooperation and the relative contributions of them differ.
No, no. I think we all agree with that sentiment 100%. I don't really have much more to say on that. Let me just follow up very briefly on the TAC question to pick up on Mike's comments. I think our sentiment was that that was a question that is symbolically important enough that the United States ought to be forward leaning. And as Mike suggested, when we talk about modalities, that's more or less the code word for figuring out how to make it work politically, given the United States Senate and the multiplicity of challenges that institution presents to any administration. But we are gratuitously placing ourselves at a disadvantage by not appearing to be as engaged in figuring out how we can sign on to the TAC as we currently appear. I think that's no.
Australia suggested that the process has been driven by the smaller countries, which I think merely demonstrates that the subterfuge worked. The subterfuge being that the concept of Pacific regionalism really began very much with Americans and secondarily with Japanese and Australians, with the Americans going back to the Rockefellers in the 1920s, but more was subsequently through CETO and through the process that led to the creation of PEC. But we had people who had the wisdom to recognize that it was much better to let the smaller countries take the initiative to the extent they would, rather than have them appear to be pushed around by the big powers. And it's good to see the same wisdom reflected in your recommendations, that we shouldn't be so much concerned about whether we're at the table if our ideas are being advanced. So that's a comment, and perhaps there's controversial content in it enough to provoke a response.
We have a brief history here of the PEC and PBEC and this process. And one of the challenges the U.S. has is we've gotten in trouble in this process from time to time because domestic politics have trumped regional strategy. Classic example would have been the 1997 financial crisis and then the 1998 APEC meeting when USTR kind of grabbed APEC and demanded and pushed for early voluntary sectoral liberalization as part of the APEC process to achieve some hard and real trade liberalization goals, because there was a real domestic political imperative for that. And that trumped some very careful tending of that garden that had been done up to that point by the administration. I think perhaps we should have stated it more explicitly, but in order to keep us in the game and to prevent that kind of thing, because as Bates said, we heard again and again, that 97-98 time period really hurt us. And in some ways, we're suffering a little bit now because we seem disinterested. So we need to get establish high enough level attention and consistent strategy and objectives in this integration process so that it has, within Washington, it has gravity of its own. It's not sort of a variable that's affected by domestic trade politics or human rights issues. You want to have a strategy from the U.S. for dealing with and making the most of this process so that we don't get sort of, end up tripping over ourselves as we did in 97-98. And some consciousness of the history and the evolution is important in that context, so we went into that.
Yeah, thank you. Steve Parker, I'm with the Development Alternatives, and I just returned from 5 years in Vietnam where we've been doing the USCID support for implementing the U.S.-Vietnam Bilateral Trade Agreement in the WTO session. So I wonder to what degree the resurgence or the surgence of Vietnam came into your discussions, number one. And number two, as you know, with the recommendations of the Eminent Persons Group for ASEAN and the recommendation to move towards a charter, which seems to be likely to be approved here in November, that really takes a major part of these institutions a step further. I'd be interested in what your views are about how serious this charter might affect ASEAN and what U.S. policy should be towards that.
Well, I have been following the Eminent Persons Group debate and the issuing of this draft charter, and I've been fascinated by it and very encouraged because, as you know well, it sounds like it was written by Thomas Jefferson in some places, emphasizing the need for ASEAN to advance universal values of human rights, constitutional government, and so forth. To some extent, this is some very wise, very eminent persons talking about the future in ways that their bureaucracies may not fully implement or understand consistently, but that's okay. A lot of this whole process is about vision and goals and setting norms and standards, and I think it's a tremendous opportunity for the U.S. It shows us that that in this region there are countries like Indonesia, for example, that are, if you look at the opinion polls, we don't do great in Indonesia, but if you look at the organizing principles for governing, they are organizing principles that we would largely agree with. And so it's sort of a question about soft power. We may not necessarily be popular across Southeast Asia, but if some of the ideas that animate our foreign policy or our allies are gaining in popularity because they are seen as critical for state success. Indonesia is not, Yudhoyono is not embracing governance and talking about these things because he thinks America plays well in Indonesia. He's doing it because that's how governance, because governance works and it's the key to political and economic success. So that's an opportunity for us to try to find ways to encourage that quietly. was distressed after we had this conference to find out that our aid budget for governance and democracy in Southeast Asia is being drastically cut. You know, how do we take advantage of this? We quietly spend a lot more money. We talk to others that are spending money, like Japan or even India, about how we can pool resources to further encourage this embrace of good governance and democratic institutions. But we don't do it by, you know, declaring we win, everybody else loses. Ha, 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 you know, it needs to be done with some subtlety. In terms of Vietnam, briefly, we didn't have someone for Vietnam. It would have been interesting because Vietnam, I think, shares in some ways this idea of an open and inclusive regional architecture in many ways, partly out of concern about China. And yet the system in Vietnam, as you know well, is still in transition and not politically where Japan or other democracies are. I think that Vietnam is behind this Eminent Persons Group charter, and as actually taking it on board is a sign that that the leadership is comfortable with gradual movements towards accepting these kinds of norms and not necessarily wedded to the non-interference in internal affairs and concerned about Burma. I find that very encouraging about Vietnam. There are lots of homework, but I find the trend positive.
Jacob Chen from Taiwan. I want to ask two quick questions. First is, Bates, you said your recommendations are mostly for the American audience. As I read your list of participants, of 20-some of them, overwhelmingly are from U.S. I don't know whether it is a locality or not. So I was thinking whether the so-called Asian views were fully expressed during the conference without benefiting of reading your paper. Secondly, about the timing of a meeting of APEC and Asian ASEAN meetings, I understand that the APEC summit usually falls about a week before Thanksgiving. I don't know about the other Asian ASEAN meetings can fit this time frame. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jacob. You prompted me to go back and look at our list, and of the core participants, I number 18, and 10 of them came from Asia. So more than half of the participants, core participants, those who were most actively engaged in our discussions, came from the region. My only other excuse would be that, well, we just need to get more money out of the Stanley Foundation next time to get more even more Asian participation. So, I mean, I'm joking, but we did our very best, I think, to try, under the limitations of budgets and distance, to have a representative sampling, and I thought we did a pretty good job. But obviously, we could have done better.
Yeah, if I can just sort of add on to that, I do think some of it is the tyranny of location. I was at a conference in Jakarta last week where, surprisingly, the Indonesian participants dominated the discussion, simply because that's where we were. I would, though, point out one other thing, which is that in the paper assignments that we made, and I know we're not able to share the papers with you, I mean, one of the things that we did ask of the participants was not just to come, the regional participants in particular, is not just to come presenting their perspective, but to survey, Chinese perspectives, Indian perspectives, Japanese perspectives. And that was our effort in a cost-effective way to try to get a fuller and broader capture of how rich and diverse the debate was throughout and across the region.
APEC, the timing of APEC is affected by the timing of the Australian rules football matches, it seems, at least this year. I mean, each country can decide when to have APEC. Of course, the East Asia Summit was supposed to occur, a month before it did, but it was moved because of concerns. And so there's some flexibility in there. We thought this was one way to think about how to have this giant confab in Asia. It's not going to happen next year, maybe not the year after. But if we're looking for ways to get India into the conversation and so forth, it's important. Frankly, I think one of the problems with the East Asia Summit, we have to think about a problem that is there perhaps by design, is that Taiwan's not in it. and Taiwan's an apex. So there's some advantage to making sure that we can maintain this open and inclusive process, and using the calendar skillfully is one way to do it.
Well, I wish we had more time for more discussion, but unfortunately, I think our allotted time here has run out. So let me just say on behalf of the Stanley Foundation, my thanks for your joining us here today, and once again, our thanks to Mike and to Bates and to CSIS for their partnership in this project.
Thank you.